Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Torah Studies, where we look at the Torah portion of the week. This week's Torah portions, Achrei Kedoshim. Friends, we have an epic class tonight. I'm calling it. We're calling it epic. This is like the called shot. Remember Babe Ruth? He was standing there, and he pointed, and then he knocked the home run right there?
Yes.
Folks, this is it. It's goats, demons, and deserts. Not desserts. That would be a very... What would that be? A goat demon dessert? Oh my gosh, can you imagine? We know what devil's food is. That's already... But imagine goat demon? Whew. No. Goats, demons, and deserts. That is the topic of tonight. Although in the Torah Studies text it says, the curious case of the scapegoat, I prefer my title. All right, let's begin. We'll open up the Chumash 736, 737. Torah portions this week. We have a double one once again. Achrei and Kedoshim, the first of the two, begins with a discussion to Aaron, the Kohen, the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, the Bit Kahuna, and his family, but specifically him, because the topic is the service on the holiest day of the year, which is, of course, help me out here. Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. We know that on the Day of Atonement, back in the day, in times of the temple, the high priest played a major role in the experience of Yom Kippur. So today, everyone shows up, we all show up to synagogue, and we try to wear white, and we don't wear leather shoes, and we don't eat, and we don't drink, and it's a whole fast day. There's all these, and we stay in synagogue all day, and there's so many prayers, and the book is like 300-400 pages, and when you ask, well, what are we going to say throughout these 24 hours, the answer is everything, and it's like, oh my gosh, the whole book, yes, the whole book, and it's a lot of prayer, and it's a lot of time, and it's a lot of, it's just a big experience. Back in the day, times of the temple, times of the Mishkan, the tabernacle, it was a little bit different. There was one individual, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, who played the major role of the day. He was the one who officiated the service. He pretty much single-handedly took care of the service of Yom Kippur. What did the people do? They observed. I'm sure they prayed on their own and they did their own thing, but the major focus of the day was on the avodah, on the service in the temple of the high priest. So what did he do? What was the service? So what he did was he came in the morning, and he wore the typical 8 garments. So we've spoken about this in other contexts, whether it's on Yom Kippur itself in synagogue or whether it was in other classes. So he would put on the 8 priestly garments, do the morning service as is typical in the temple, although the high priest himself wouldn't usually do it. There were other priests that would do it. On this day, he did everything A to Z. So he did the morning service, and then he got changed. And then after that was done, he switched into pure white garments. None of the 8 garments that had gold interwoven in all of them. White linen garments, 4 white linen garments, and he performed the special service of Yom Kippur. So let's read it inside. Let's read about the service inside. Lisa, please take us, please get us started with 739, service of Yom Kippur. What are we skipping, if you're wondering? What are the first few verses? The first few verses say that the high priest, Aaron, and his family should not go to the Holy of Holies at any time that they wish. Rather, they can only go at the appropriate time. What is the appropriate time? One day a year, it's only on Yom Kippur. And what do you do on Yom Kippur in the Holy of Holies? What's the service like? 739, Lisa.
The service of Yom Kippur. Aaron should enter the Holy of Holies only on Yom Kippur, when he should bring these offerings and a young bull for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. He should wear a linen tunic that belongs to the holy sanctuary. Linen pants should be on his body. He should gird himself with a linen sash. He should place a linen turban on his head. Since these are holy garments, he should immerse in mikveh water before he puts them on.
Okay, so the first thing we have is wardrobe. What's he wearing, right? Right, they would ask the high priest, "Who are you wearing on the white carpet?" Because it's Yom Kippur. They don't have a red carpet. Who does that? It's blasphemous. Anyway, so he would wear the white garment. So now we know what he's wearing. Now, what does he do? What are the offerings? What's the service like? 741. Please continue.
He should take from the community of the children of Israel 2 male goats as a sin offering and and one ram as a burnt offering.
By the way, let's focus. We're going to, although we're going to read a number of verses about a number of different things, I want you all to pay attention to what happens with the goats. The goats are going to be the main thing. Remember, the class is not titled Rams, Demons, and Deserts. It's just not. It's straight up goats, demons, and deserts. So folks, focus on the goats. By the way, today goat means something else. We know this, right? We've talked about this. You learned it from me. This is my, like, these crowning achievements. Like, what is goat? It used to be the worst. Oh, because you finally got it. Welcome. Welcome 2018. Goat stands. Goat used to be like somebody messed up. They were the goat, like a derogatory term. But now it's like a laudatory term. It stands for greatest of all time. Greatest of all time, G-O-A-T, goat. I wouldn't even try. Okay, I'm going to stay far away. All right, continue, please.
Aaron should first bring his own sin offering bull and confess over it, atoning for himself and for his household. And he should take the two male communal goats and place them before God at the entrance of the tent of the meeting. Aaron should place lots upon the two male goats, and one lot for God, and the other lot for casting off a high cliff.
So let's focus on this for just 1 second. Two goats. They were identical goats. Identical in size and appearance, in height, in... Is that what goats do? Did they do that? Did I do that right? They should look at the same look and appearance, as close as possible. And you stand them up. One. The high priest stands in front of them. One on his right, one on his left. And he draws lots. There were two lots made out of wood or made out of gold, whatever. Different times had different types of lots. One said LaHashem, and one said LaAzazel. One said for God, and one said for the high cliff. For the high cliff. And he would pick up the right one and attach it to the right goat, to his right. The left one to the left goat. And one said for God, one said for the high cliff. Let's continue. We're going to get there.
Aaron should bring the male goat upon which the lot for God came up and designated as a sin offering. The male goat upon which the lot for casting off a high cliff came up should be placed before God while it is still alive to confess on it, atoning for the Jewish people before it is sent away to the high cliff to its death in the desert.
Okay, so... That LaHashem goat was sacrificed in the temple. The LaAzazel, which we're translating here as the high cliff. So the one to be sent away, LaAzazel, to the high cliff, that there was a confession upon that goat, and then it was sent away to its demise. Okay, continue please.
Aaron should bring his own sin offering bull, and he should confess upon it again, avowing for himself and for his priestly household. Then he should slaughter his sin offering bull.
Okay, so we're going to fast forward a few verses to get back to the goats, but I just want to make sure that we all have a picture of what's going on. So it would begin with Aaron, the high priest. Aaron, who was the high priest then, he brought a personal bull offering. Then he did the lot on. Then he cast the lots on the goats. Then he had a second bull. This is not the same bull as before. So he had a second bull that he confessed over. Or maybe, no, I'm sorry, maybe he confessed over the same bull, but a second time. I think it was the same bull. Yeah, there was only one bull. But he confessed over it a second time, this time not on his own behalf, but on behalf of himself and all of the other Kohanim, all of the other priests, the priestly household. Then he slaughtered, finally, after these two confessions, one on behalf of himself, and one on behalf of himself and all of the priests, he would then slaughter that sin offering bull. Now, then we talk about the incense. The incense brought to the Holy of Holies. We're going to fast forward through all this because it's not the main focus of the lesson. Let us continue. I'm going to summarize quickly. So there was the incense offering in the Holy of Holies. He would then take some of the bull's blood and sprinkle it in the inner altar, by the ark in the Holy of Holies. He then slaughtered the male goat. That was LaHashem. That was for God. He slaughtered that as a sin offering for the people. Let's fast forward. Here we go. Verse 20, bottom of 743. 743, last paragraph. Please continue.
When he is finished atoning for the Holy of Holies, the tent of meeting, and the golden altar, he should bring the living male goat.
And the living male goat is the second goat that was not slaughtered. Remember, one was for God and one was to be sent away. The one for God has already been slaughtered and its blood has already been sprinkled. We skip that. But trust me on that. What we're left with is the living goat. It won't be living that much longer. But so thus far, the living goat, and that was the La'azazel goat. That was to be sent away to the high cliff. Continue.
Aaron should lean both of his hands upon the living male goat's head and confess all the sins of the Jewish people upon it, all their intentional and unintentional sins. He will thus place the sins on the male goat's head and send it off to the desert with a pre-designated man. The male goat will thus carry upon itself all their sins to an uninhabited land. He should send off the male goat into the desert.
Okay, so there we have it. So the goat is sent away into the desert. Now what happened next? So we don't actually need to continue reading over here because I think we're pretty good over here. Thank you. So what happened next is that they would send the goat. Let's take a look inside. Let's take a look inside the Torah Studies text. Please open up your books or your copies to page number 42. Text 2a. Maimonides, Rambam. Rambam fills in some gaps. 2a talks about the lottery process in more detail. And 2b talks about, and other texts talk about what happened when they sent away the goat. So thus far, all we know is that the second goat that was designated Lazazel was sent away to a high place to its death. But what are the details? What are the gory details? Those remain to be seen. Peter. Page 42, text 2a, Rambam.
Okay. There were two lots. Upon one was written for God, and upon the other for Azazel. He would quickly grab the lots from the kalpi, urn for drawing lots, and lift up the two lots in his two hands for the two goats. He would open his hands. He would then place the two lots on the two goats. The lot his right hand on the goat to his right, and the lot his left hand on the goat to his left. He ties a crimson cord weighing 2 shekels on the head of the goat to be sent to Azazel, and positions it in the direction where it will be sent.
Okay, so that's it. So the new information we got from that text is that they would tie some sort of crimson cord that had a certain weight on it for some reason. They would tie it to the head of the goat, be sent to Azazel, and they pointed it to the direction that it would be sent to. Text 2b, if you don't mind, please continue one more. Maimonides continues to fill in some more details.
Afterward, he would send the living goat to be taken to the desert with a person prepared for this task. Booths were built on the way from Jerusalem to the desert. One person or many people would spend the day in each booth so they would accompany him from booth to booth. In each booth, they would say, here is food and here is water. If he became weak and it was necessary for him to eat, he would eat, but no one ever required this. The people in the last booth would stand at the end of the Sabbath limits and watch his actions from a distance.
You with me so far on this? Does everyone understand why they set up booths? Why they set up booths? What was the purpose of the booths? So one guy was appointed to take the goat to the cliff. Why booths? What is this, like a marathon? What's going on? Someone fill in the gap? It's not a trick question. It's a simple question. What day is it? What's this guy doing?
Fasting.
He's fasting. But schlepping a goat in the middle of the wilderness, he might get fatigued, he might get hungry, he might get thirsty. Instead of him carrying food and water with him, they would set up booths beforehand, lemonade stands or whatever, cookie stands, and if he got hungry or thirsty, then he would have something to eat, but it never got to that. But they set that up to be safe. Does it make sense? Yes? Okay. Let's continue, please.
What would he do? He would divide the crimson cord tied to the goat's horns. He would tie half to a rock and half between its two horns. He would then push it backward and it would roll over and descend. It would not reach half of the mountain before it was broken into separate limbs. He would then sit in the last booth until nightfall. Sentries would be positioned along the way who would wave flags so that the people in the temple would know that the goat reached the desert.
Make sense? So, yes? Mm-hmm. Sort of?
Yeah.
Okay, as much as I can thus far, right? So the guy would take it, the designated fellow would take it to the cliff, to the mountaintop, and then he would push it over backwards. And it would tumble down, and it was so sharp and jagged and rocky that it didn't even make it down to the bottom. It was already ripped into pieces. Everyone ate already, right? Everyone's...
Yes, you know, yeah.
It's, yeah. Might be slaughtering an animal also is not a pretty thing. I'm just saying, shechting an animal is also taking the life of an animal. But yeah, this I think does evoke more of a visceral response. I don't know that there's any way to to modify this. Well, it doesn't really mean that it was broken until now. It pretty much says that. I mean, I don't know that there's a way to. And this is what they would do. They would push it off the cliff, and it would reach its demise even before it reached the bottom of the mountaintop. Okay. And then Maimonides adds that they would have sentries, they would have different people, different guards positioned along the way. When he was done, he would give the signal, and then they would wave a flag, and then the next one closer to the temple would wave a flag, and then when they saw the flags, they would continuously wave the flag from one to the other, and that's how, before texting, even on Yom Kippur, you couldn't really do the texting. So this was a very holiday Yom Kippur-friendly way of passing along a message that indeed the service was done, and they would wait for that in the temple. But there was another way that back in the temple they would know that the service was done. And some of you may be familiar with this tradition. Anybody know? How would they know when this...
Was it about the color of the...
Yes. What was the color of the rope or the thread?
It was red.
It was crimson. It was red. Roll Tide. Kidding. It was red. Alabama thing. Sorry, Georgia people. Anyway, what happened when the service happened and God atoned the Jewish people? Turned white. Let's take a look at 3a. Ray, please read 3a from the Mishnah.
Rabbi Ishmael stated, a strip of crimson wool was tied to the door of the heichal, and when the goat reached the wilderness, the crimson wool turned white, as it is written, though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow.
Okay, so here we have a Talmudic tradition from the Mishnah tradition, that there was another rope, string, or strip of material, crimson wool, that was tied to the temple itself. So there was one that was tied to the animal. We read that before. One was tied also to the heichal. The heichal was the inner, not the innermost, but one of the inner chambers of the temple where the menorah was and the outer, not the outer altar, the inner altar was, and where the table of the showbread, whatever. I'm just kind of giving you some points of reference if you're familiar where these things were in the temple. So it was one of the inner chambers, not the Holy of Holies, but what we would call the Holies. So that's where they put this wool, and then it would change colors. There's an interesting Talmudic explanation of how this evolved, because originally the strip of red thread in the temple was not there. It was more outside facing the people, but then it got too hectic. Ray, please continue to read text 3b.
Our sages taught, at first they would tie this strip of crimson to the opening of the entrance hall of the temple on the outside. If the strip turned white, they would rejoice, as this indicated that their sins had been atoned for. If it did not turn white, they would be sad and ashamed.
Can you imagine what would go on from the time that the goat started going? Right? Try to picture this. There's a temple with who knows how many thousands and tens of thousands of people. And you have now this goat that represents, that's carrying all of the sins of the Jewish people. And it's been sent off by some dude. And we don't know exactly how long it's going to take and when it's going to happen. What do you have? You have this miraculous sign. You have this piece of crimson wool tied to the outside, originally to the outside of the entrance to that building, to that holy, to the Kodesh, to the it's called the Ulam, whatever, that's the chamber that goes to the, whatever, it was tied to the outside, facing the courtyard where the people would be. Can you imagine what was going on? What do you think was going on? Anxious. And what do people do in a crowd when they're filled with anxiety? When they're anxious and they have to, and they're trying to catch a glimpse of something? Can you imagine? You have thousands of people, and what's everyone trying to do? See that thing. And only the first few rows, you know, only the first few rows are going to be able to see it. People are probably climbing shoulders, and they're pushing. I mean, you can imagine the chaos. So it was changed. Continue. Not everyone could go in to see. You couldn't just go. You had to be a priest doing this or whatever. You couldn't just walk into that space to see it. So that's why they avoided that whole spectacle.
And they would still peek and see. If it turned white, they would rejoice. And if it did not turn white, they would be sad. Therefore, the sages established that they should tie half of the strip to the rock and half of it between the goat's horns, so that the people would not know what happened to the strip until after the conclusion of Yom Kippur.
So they moved the string inside, but people still pushed to try to catch a glimpse. So they said, no more string, no more wool, crimson wool thread situation, no more indicator strip inside the temple or around the temple. We're going to keep it by the rock where the goat was actually pushed off the cliff. So the only one that would know if it turned white or remained red was the fellow who took the goat. So he basically took the goat. He led the goat. He took half the thread from that was around the goat's horns, put it on a rock at the top of the mountain, pushed the goat off, and then observed what would happen to the wool. And then he would go to his little booth until the end of the holiday, and he would indicate that indeed it had been pushed off, but only he carried that secret of whether it was white or whether it stayed red until after the holiday. So that people, so just kind of, you know, nothing to see. There's no reason to push, no reason to be anxious, because you're not going to know anyway till after the Chag, yeah.
Was there ever a time when it didn't turn white?
The implication is that there might have been. Right.
They knew it was going to turn white.
Right. If it doesn't turn white, like, what does that mean? Like, oh, we really done wrong this year, folks. Hopefully it always turned white. I'm going to be in the optimistic camp.
So in Judaism, the goat died for your sins.
Crazy, right?
And in Christianity, they got this concept.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can see how things are derived, right? How things kind of are pulled out. So you have this notion, this is probably the only instance, you have sin offerings in the temple where you slaughter an animal as a sin offering or as a guilt offering or whatever, but a sacrificial goat that is pushed off a cliff and basically dies for our sins, yeah, that's Yom Kippur. And I have to tell you, there's no mention in the binding of Isaac when God speaks to Abraham that he needs to bind his son because of sin. There's no mention of iniquity, of sin, of wrongdoing or anything. God just says, take your son, bring him as an offering. So that concept of a sacrificial situation for sin, again, you do have sacrifices. Right, yeah, I mean, that's basically, right, you have sacrifices that are sacrifices that are, some are sin and some are guilt offerings and whatever, but this stands unique, and this was on Yom Kippur. This is what happened. This was a major part of Yom Kippur, which is the holiest day of the year. This is what happened. You know, they didn't, I don't know what they didn't do, but this was what they did. This was a major piece of it. Now, this evokes a lot of questions, some which we've kind of touched on and some which I think we haven't touched on yet. And the core question is, are you kidding me? Are you serious? Is this what we're doing now? Is this it? We're throwing goats off cliffs? Mazel tov, we're atoned for our sins? Is that literally what's going on? You can understand that a commandment such as this, a mitzvah such as this, would raise many an eyebrow, amongst the Jewish community, perhaps, and amongst those that had a beef or an axe to grind with the Jewish people. In other words, somebody might say, this is Judaism? This, right, your holiest day of the year, and you're throwing goats off cliffs backward? That's what's happening? It's for kicks? For your atonement? You sinned, so that goat has to die? Really? Okay, text 4. Mike. The Talmud says the following.
In my statutes you shall keep.
By the way, can I just say something?
Sure.
Just one thing. You know, you made the point about the goat going backwards, but mm-hmm. There's less fear going if you're going to push backwards than facing.
I guess.
Straight ahead.
Still not pleasant for the goat, though. I mean, I hear what you're saying. It's better, I guess.
Yes.
In my statutes you shall keep. These are things that Satan laughs at. Abstaining from eating pork, from wearing chutneys.
Chutneys is the wool and linen. We're not meant to wear wool and linen in the same garment.
The chalitza ceremony, purification of a leper, and the dispatching of the Azazel goat. Lest you say they are nonsense, it is therefore written, I am the Lord your God. I have commanded it. You have no right to question.
So the Talmud says a few things. Number one, it says Satan, the Satan. It says Dvarim Shehas Satan Meishev Alehin. These are things that Satan kind of pushes back on and says, what's going on? What's this prohibition against eating pork, wearing wool and linen together, the Chalitza ceremony, which is the ceremony that kind of takes away the obligation from the brother of a deceased husband who didn't have children with his wife for marrying her. That was a really long way of saying the mitzvah. There's a mitzvah that if a couple is married and the husband passes away and they don't have children, so there's a mitzvah that the brother should consider marrying her to have children. Sorry? Biblical law, you can marry, I don't know. According to Torah law, you can marry more than one wife, one woman, officially. I don't know if it was only binding on, I don't know if biblically it was only binding. I mean, that hasn't been Jewish practice for thousands of years. So yeah, that wouldn't be in a case, but I don't know if the original law had that disclaimer or not. I don't know. But anyway, it's the brother, so a brother is said that he should ideally marry her to continue the family, the name, the line, whatever it is, for his brother who is deceased and they didn't have children. But if he doesn't want to, or she doesn't want to, so then you perform a ceremony called chalitza, which breaks that bond. So that's also like a strange ritual. You take a shoe, and she spits by the shoe, and it's a whole situation. Whatever. Anybody familiar with the chalitza?
Heard of it?
Huh? The shoe is binding, right? Exactly. No, you untie the shoe, and then that's what does it. Anyway, whatever. So again, these are things that people look at and scratch their head and say, this is a little crazy. The purification of a leper, which we just read in last week's Torah portion. So you take two birds, you slaughter one bird, you put the blood of the bird in water, and the other bird you dip in the blood, and then you send it off. It's like, why? Like, what's going on here? And the last confusing or confounding mitzvah that's mentioned here is the dispatching. I like that phrase, dispatching. Dispatching. We got dispatch on
it's like
Breaker 1 for
it's
him.
Like engagement on the theater for the military.
Dispatch, right, yeah.
No, I'm saying it's like military speak, you know, instead of saying
exactly.
You know, slaughter the enemy.
Right, it's dispatching.
Engage them.
Engage the enemy, right.
Theater.
Right. Right. Exactly. Right.
Really
so
true.
We're dispatching of the goats.
Right.
We're dispatching of it. And then the Talmud concludes and says, lest you say that it's nonsense, so the conclusion of these mitzvot, it says, I am the Lord your God. In other words, God says, it's my will, this is what I want. You can try to figure it out, you don't figure it out. Either way, this is what I want. you have no right to question it and or to scoff at it. So this is so the first point of our exploration is to say, look, even if we don't understand it, the Talmud has already addressed this about 1,800 years ago and has said, it may not be understandable to the human mind. Nonetheless, it's clearly God's will, as God specifies in the Torah. God is preempting the question by saying, I know you're not going to fully relate to it, perhaps, but still, this is what I'm telling you, this is what I want. It's almost like God is saying, rely upon all of the other things that make a ton of sense, and trust me, this also works on some level. Whether you understand it or not, this is the way it is. Now, tonight, we're actually going to break it down and seek to understand it. So we're not going to just accept it and say, well, God said, you know, Ani Hashem, I am God, this is what I'm saying, so okay, all right, we'll submit to what you want. No questions, all right. Forget the questions. We're not going to take that approach. Because we know that traditionally, even when we have a mitzvah that is a chok, that is, quote, a divine decree, one that doesn't necessarily have a lot of rationale behind it, even when we have a mitzvah like that, the commentaries, the sages throughout the centuries, throughout the millennia, have explored, have given some sort of rationale to explain it, and they've made it meaningful. So we're going to seek to try to find some meaning in this seemingly incomprehensible mitzvah. So, first thing we're going to do, we're going to skip text 5, which is just Rashi explaining what the word Azazel means. And he says Azazel means a high, rocky place. We're going to skip that because we already mentioned that. Let's move on to text number... Ooh, you know what? I don't know that I want to read text number 6. I think I'm going to paraphrase. So, let's... Hold on. Okay, let me ask a few questions, a few additional questions, and then we're going to skip text 6 as well. I think the next text we're going to read is text number 7. Okay, good. Let me ask a few questions. So, number 1. Not only is the mitzvah of this Azazel goat, or this ceremony, or this ritual, or this procedure, this dispatching of the Azazel goat, confounding on a very basic level, like what's going on, but if you look at it a little bit closer, it's even more confounding. And I'm going to share with you 2 points. Point number 1. This was a goat of atonement. It's clear that this is meant for the atonement of the Jewish people. It's on the day of Yom Kippur, which is the day of atonement. It's a special ritual on that day. The priest, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, recites confession for all the Jewish people, intentional and unintentional sins, on that goat, and then placing the sins on the head of that goat, and then dispatches it. It's clear that it's meant as a goat of atonement. So question number 1. We find that every other atonement offering was shechted, was slaughtered. There was a central, there was a consistent thing that was done for atonement in the temple. And that is you take an animal, which also could be asked and could be questioned, but that's not tonight's class. You take an animal, and there's a vidui, which is a confession that the one bringing the offering says, placing the hands on the animal. There's a confession that's recited about the sins, if it was a sin offering, upon the animal. The Kohen, the priest, takes the animal, shechts it, slaughters it, and then continues to do its thing, to do his thing with the rest of the ritual of that sacrifice, of that offering. There's one exception. So that's when it comes to atonement, 364 days of the year. On Yom Kippur, how is atonement? And even on Yom Kippur, how does the Kohen Gadol himself get atonement? And how do all the Kohanim, all the priests get atonement? It's through the bull. Remember the bull? And what happened with the bull? It was sacrificed. It was slaughtered. It was shechted. There's one exception. For the people, on Yom Kippur, the atonement happens not through shechting the animal, but through what? Dispatching the animal. Through sending it away. Like we tell the kids in school. What happens to the other goat? They send it away. They send it away. Where? To a goat farm, you would think. No, what? We don't, right? We don't get into all the gory details. But this goat is sent away and sent off the edge of a cliff. Why? Why isn't it slaughtered like every other offering, every other atonement ritual in Jewish practice, in ancient Jewish practice? They were all slaughtered. This is the one exception. Why? Number 2. Every single offering and every atonement offering, every service that involved atonement and the priest, etc., it all happened where? In the temple. Where does this happen? It starts in the temple with the confession, with the vidui. Where does it end up? Far outside. Far outside. The edge of a desolate cliff somewhere in the desert. What's going on? Atonement is usually happening in the mikdash, in the temple. And here it's happening, the edge of a cliff. To the point that they need signals. They need red strings to indicate whether it happened or not. From a distance. They needed flags. A flag system. That yeah, it happened. Why? So these are some anomalies. These are messages that there's something interesting, something compelling happening here. Number one, it's strange. Number two, it's not being slaughtered. Number three, it's not happening in the temple. You with me so far? Very curious. Number four, what is the deeper message? What is the personal message for us? We're not throwing goats off cliffs nowadays. We haven't done that for a while. Sorry. If anybody was like, oh, no, not happening. We don't have a temple. We're not throwing goats off cliffs or pushing them backwards off cliffs. So what is the timeless, relevant message for us? So let's begin. Let me outline now the framework for the rest of the class. I'm going to present two classic answers, one from Maimonides, Rambam, and one from the Ibn Ezra, and Ramban, Nachmanides. So Ibn Ezra and Ramban, they will tag team to give us the second answer. The first one is Maimonides, Rambam, and his Guide for the Perplexed. The second one is from the other classic commentaries. Now, we're going to quickly go through the first one and focus a lot on the second one. And that is unbelievable. And like I told a few people that were here earlier on before the class, this is something that I can almost guarantee that I don't think anyone around this table has heard. And I think we'll all think to ourselves, hearing the second answer, that does not sound Jewish at all. That's going to be your first reaction. That really does not sound Jewish. How is this a thing? Okay? I'm preparing you. Let's begin. Who are we up to?
Mike Senior.
Mike, what do you call yourself?
Senior.
Can I call you Mike the Elder? Is that worse?
No, I like it.
Mike the Elder. Mike the Elder.
Sounds so wise.
Sounds so wise, right? The Elder. I'm quoting the Elder. All right. So now, jump in. Rambam, Maimonides, text 7. Oh, by the way, secret codes. We're going to get to secret codes also tonight. This is going to be fantastic. We don't have a lot of time, but we're going to get to it. Text 7, Rambam. This is the easy answer. This is like the soft... I'm not putting it down. I'm just saying it's like the softball answer, the feel-good answer, the PC answer, the philosophical answer. This is Rambam. Go. Somebody explain Rambam. I'll do it, but I want you to tell me if you understand what he's saying. He's addressing the core question. I'll tell you what he's addressing, then you tell me what he's answering. He's addressing the core question, why are we sending away a goat with our sins in the desolate desert? What's going on with that? And what's his simple answer?
It's symbolic.
Symbolic. So he's saying, let's gloss over all the details and all of our, perhaps, like, dis-ease with this whole thing. And he says, look, it's symbolic. And what's the symbolism? But well, what's the symbolism for the individual? What's the general symbolism? What are you doing with your stuff? It's so that part of my life, that mistake, that error is outside. It's no longer here.
It's tashlik in a desert.
It's tashlik in a desert. It's like when we feed the fish, we cast away our sins to the thing. But there, the pond still is right there. This is even further. This is somewhere, and it's broken, and it breaks apart, and it disintegrates. It's like, poof, it's gone. It's no more. No more, no more negative, no more negativity, no more evil ties, no more past, no more negative past, etc. So if you feel stuck, if you feel tethered to a mistake or whatever, so this symbolically releases you of the past and allows you to embrace a better future.
You're absolved.
You're absolved. And that's why you take the goat and you don't do it in the temple. You don't do it where the people are. You send it away so that the message is that all of the negativity should be totally outside, totally removed from our environment. Sounds wonderful. God forbid, putting it down. What I'm saying is it's a very, like, it's like a feel good-esque type answer. It's like, why send away the goat? Because we're sending away all of the things. We're releasing all the toxic energy that we want to get rid of, and that's dissipating in the ether, whatever it's called. And, you know, it's gone. It's finished. Okay. We're going to move off of that answer and present. Wow. I don't even know how to characterize this. Sarah, you are reading text 8a, if you dare. And there's so many different ways that we could have done this, that we could do this. But I think we'll just do it in a straightforward fashion. Text 8a, 51.
If you can understand the secret behind the word Gabriel, you will understand its hidden meaning and the hidden meaning of its name. Indeed, there are similar words in the Torah. I will partially reveal the secret by way of a hint. When you are 33 years old, you will understand.
This is not a joke. This is his commentary on the verse. This is literally what he says. It's not exact. The translation is not 100% accurate. There are a few things that I found that I'm taking issue with. But in general, that's what he's saying. He's saying, I have an understanding of it, and I'm not going to tell you. That's literally what he's saying. What he's saying is, the Ibn Ezra is saying, I have an explanation of this Azazel ritual, and I'm not telling it to you. He says, if you can understand the secret behind the word Azazel, you will understand its hidden meaning and the hidden meaning of its name. If you understand it, then you'll understand it. I will partially reveal the secret by way of hint. When you are 33, you'll understand it. And that's what he says. And he closes it out. That's the end of his commentary. You would think the commentaries are hooking up a brother and a sister. It's like, help us out here. Give me some answers. Give me some insight. And he says, there's secret meaning. And if you understand it, you'll understand it. That doesn't help. And a hint is, when you're 33, you'll get it. He doesn't say when you're 33 years old. He says, when you are 33, you'll understand it. When you're ben shalosh, ben shloshim v'shalosh, tadeinu. When you're 30 and through, when you're 33, you'll understand it. What's he saying? What is this? And that's it. Talk about cryptic commentary. This is total anomaly. This is not something that's normally done in the commentaries. The commentaries usually ask a question, give a perspective, give an insight, whatever, give us a commentary. But this, he knows what we're struggling with. Everyone's struggling with the same thing. What is this Azazel? What is this? You're sending a goat off a cliff. You're not shechting it. You're not slaughtering it. You're not doing it at the temple. What's going on over here? And he says, there's a deep secret. There's a mystery. And there's a meaning. And your hint is 33, the number 33. Here's the good news. There are other commentaries that decode the secret meaning of this commentary. So you and I don't need to do this on our own, because this would take a long time. Has anyone here been in an escape room? Or know what escape... Yeah, you were in an escape room? It's a lot of fun. You've been in an escape room? No.
Not in the room, but my daughter went for birthday.
So you got the scoop on it.
We didn't escape, but we could see on the TV.
You could see on the TV. It's incredible. You get these clues and hints, and you got to figure out and decode like secret meanings and messages and whatnot. It's crazy. It's fun. It's amazing. So we don't have to do it. It's already been done. So to get the decoded answer, let's turn the page, or maybe not. I don't know if you have to turn the page. But let's look at Nachmanides, Ramban. Ramban says, I will explain to you what the Ibn Ezra is saying. He lived basically 100 years after the previous commentary, who dropped it in the clue. So a century later, he basically decoded for us what that means. And he said, what does it mean you'll understand it at 33? Count 33 verses. It doesn't say when you're 33 years old. He says, when you're 33, when you've advanced 33 verses, then you'll have a verse that speaks to the meaning of what this ritual is. So what is the 33rd verse from this verse? Text 8b. Sarah, please continue.
That's at the top of page 52.
52. This is a prohibition against idolatry and idol worship. And the Torah says, "V'lo yizbechu od," they should no longer sacrifice as zevchehen, their offerings, la'se'irim, to the se'irim. In Hebrew, what is se'irim? What is se'ir? It means goat. Do not offer your sacrifices no longer to the goats. But that's not how it's translated in the Chumash. If you look in the English edition of this Chumash, you don't have to, but I'll tell you what it says. Or, you know what, let's look it up inside ourselves. Let's look it up. This is page 749. I'm going to read this super, super fast. Take a look at verse number 7. It's in the middle of the page, that middle paragraph, the last sentence of that middle paragraph. You see that? They should no longer slaughter their sacrifices to
demons.
To demons. Huh. Goats or demons? Goats or demons? Historically, there have been demons that have been depicted as goats. You ever see that? See, like, human figures with, like, goat heads and goat features? It's like a certain type of demon type creature. Chagall painted that?
Yeah.
Okay. There you go. He knew this stuff. He studied the Ramban. Or the Torah.
Is a good demon in his painting?
Could be. I don't know. I'm not well versed in that. But here's the deal. Here's the deal. The literal meaning of the verse is do not sacrifice. Do not bring offerings to demonic spirits. Like the pagans who lived in Israel, or like the idol worshippers who lived in Israel would. So don't follow their ways. Don't serve idols. Don't sacrifice offerings to the demons that they do. But the word for demon is seir, which is goat. What is pushed off the cliff? A goat. Okay. Let's keep on going. Not, this is not supposed to make sense yet. If you can't piece it together, you're not supposed to yet. I'm just dropping some clues as we proceed to delve into the Ramban Nachmanides. Text 9a. Steve, please read this one, 52.
Well, Reshit Rabba explains the verse, the he-goat shall thus carry upon itself all the sins of Anatom. This means that Esau, who is called Seir, will bear the sins of the people of Jacob, who is called Ham.
Okay, so this is a play on words that Nachmanides does based on the Midrash in Bereishit Rabbah. And he says, goat, se'ir, is related to the word demon, which we saw in 8b. It's also related to Esau, who is the brother of Jacob, who is known to be the father of the nation of Seir. They were also called Har Seir. It's like Esau's family and legacy is called Seir or Seir as well. So it says like this. It says that, so Nachmanides is basically saying that the goat carries the sins, avonotam. Tam means pure. Tam is a reference to Yaakov and his children, the Jewish people. And avonotam means not only their sins, but the sins of the Jews. The sins of the Jews are involved somehow, need to, in order to atone for the sins of the Jews, it needs to be carried by Esau, Yaakov's brother. What? So to get rid of Jewish sins, you have to involve the spirit of Esav. What does that mean? Esav, the goat, the demonic spirit. All synonymous, all sayer and seer. What does that mean? We still don't have clarity. Text 9b will fill in all the blanks. Continue, Steve.
It was explained in Pirkei, Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, that a bride is given to Samuel in Yom Kippur so that he doesn't try to nullify their offering to God.
Let me stop you for a second. When it says Samael, it's actually not Samuel, it's Samael. Samael is another, is a euphemism for Satan, the Satan. So, listen to this. A bribe is given to the Satan on Yom Kippur so that he doesn't try to nullify their offering to God. In other words, when the Jewish people are advocating for their atonement and pleading to God for their forgiveness and to wipe the slate clean, at the same time, the Satan, who is known as the prosecuting angel, is putting forth a case of prosecution, a negative case against the Jewish people. So what happens? We're buying off the prosecutor. Are you with me on this? We're on Yom Kippur. We're buying off the prosecutor so that he drops the case. I'm going to say it again. We're buying off Satan, so that he drops the case against the Jewish people on Yom Kippur. How do we do this? Please continue. As the verse states, sorry. Third line.
States, one lot for God and the other lot for Azazel. Azazel portion is the sin offering goat, which bears upon it all the sins of Israel, as the verse states, the he-goat shall thus carry upon itself all their sins. Samuel would thus see on Yom Kippur that there is no sin among Israel, and would say to God, Master of the universe, you have one nation on the earth that is like the angels of heaven. Just as the angels are barefoot, Israel is barefoot on Yom Kippur. Just as the angels don't eat or drink, the people of Israel don't eat or drink on Yom Kippur. Just as the angels are free from all sin, the people of Israel are free of all sin on Yom Kippur. God would hear their praise, at this praise of the Jewish people coming from their prosecuting angel, and would atone for the altar, for the temple, for the Kohanim, and for the entire congregation.
So the Ramban could not be more clear. Thank you. The Ramban says very, very clearly. He says that what was the objective? And I think they cut out a little too much. They were trying to condense the text here. So I think they cut out some of the major punch, because it's very clear when you read it inside. Ramban is saying, why? What, one goat was offered in the temple to God. What was the other goat? It was sent off a cliff. Why was it sent off a cliff? He says that was an offering to Satan. Are you with me on this? Do you understand the implications of this? On Yom Kippur, you're sending a goat as an offering to the evil force, to the dark side, to Satan. It's known as Samael, who is otherwise prosecuting the Jewish people. And once he gets his goat, gift, he changes his tune. And he says, oh, the Jewish people, they're like the angels. They don't eat or drink. They don't wear leather shoes. They're free of sin, just like the angels. And then God hears the praise of the Jewish people coming from the prosecuting angel. And he says, indeed, they are atoned. Why the goat? Why send the goat? We asked before, why not sacrifice it and in the temple? Because it's not to Hashem. How do you feel about this? Anybody feel a little weird about this? Weirded out? We're on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year. We're offering a bribe to Satan by giving. And Satan, as we're about to read, resides in a very desolate, destructive place. Very dark and foreboding cliff. Sharp edges. That's where the Satan lies. That's where Esav is. That's where the dark force is. That's why the goat was sent there. You're feeding, you're placating Satan in order to forgive the Jewish people. Okay, let's continue. Let's continue the magic. 9C. Marneen, are you up to it? You got a copy? You're going to pass? All right. Dan, please read text 9C. If you're up to page 55 or 56.
Eternal, our the Jewish people to send the Yom Kippur, a goat to the desert, to the minister of governance, places of desolation. And the goat is best suited to some man because he is its owner, and he is the source of destruction and desolation. He causes the fate of the sword, of blood, war, and strife, of injury and affliction, divisiveness and destruction. He takes his place among the nations in Esau, Seir, inherited the sword of war. Among animal life, he takes his place among the goats, Seir. Likewise, he is associated with the demons, called Seir in the Torah. For he and his nation are called Seir. Now, the purpose of the scapegoat is not to serve as a sacrifice for us to the Spirit, God forbid. Rather, the purpose is to fulfill the will of God who has commanded us.
So a few very important pieces of this text. Number one, he says like this, look, we are not allowed to serve idols, but this is not idol worship. Why? Because God told us to do it. You with me on the logic? He says, God says you can't worship idols. So how can we send a goat to the demon, to Satan, to Satan? That doesn't sound like we're, because God said to do it. If God says to do it, you're not worshiping God. You're not worshiping idols. Who are you worshiping? Huh?
God.
Right? God says, give a goat there. And you give a goat there. Who are you serving? God. Because God instructed you to do so. But where is it going? It's going to placate this evil force. And this dark force, he says, it's the minister of destruction. Sounds like a wrestling character, fellow, right? The minister of destruction. It's the minister of evil, destruction, desolation, sword, blood, war, strife, injury, affliction, divisiveness, destruction, Esav, evil, demons, goats. Somehow got involved in this. Same word, Seir, right? So that's why, so God says to do it, so we do it. Text 9D, I'm going to summarize. Basically, he concludes this idea by saying that he says the following. He gives an example of the king who throws a banquet. And the banquet is run by whoever runs, you know, the master of ceremonies. Whoever's running the show, but it's the king's banquet, but there's a guy that's the point person, right? And the king says to the point person, give some food or invite to the banquet one of the servants. So he does. Who invited the servant? Who fed the servant? The guy in charge of the meal or the king? Who actually fed him? The king. Although it's the guy who physically delivered the food to him, but he did so at the behest of the king. So the king fed. So therefore, we are not... giving a sacrifice, giving an animal to Satan. Who's giving the animal? Hashem. God says to do it. So we're not giving the animal. Hashem is. Why? Because God wants the Satan also to agree that the Jewish people should deserve a good year. And the only way that's going to happen, according to this construct, is if we give him a goat. Is if he gets a goat. He's got to get his goat. Right? That's it. Or else, like, he's upset. He's like, oh, haven't had my morning coffee, my morning goat. So, give him a goat, and he'll get off your case. But who says it? God. So who's giving that offering? God. The Jewish people, are the ones that are actually delivering it. Fine, but it's not coming from them. It's God's request. That's why, the Ramban says, that's why there's a lottery to decide which one goes where. Because we're not choosing animals to send to Azazel. Let God decide. You see, if we chose an animal and said, this animal is going off the cliff, then that's too much us. That's too much us choosing to feed Satan, this demonic situation. That's too much us. So even the choice of the animal comes through a lottery which is in the hands of God. You with me? That's how he finishes his composition. That's why the Ebn Ezra doesn't say it. Who's going to write this? He's going to write this. He says, no, there's a secret, there's a deeper meaning, you have to look elsewhere to figure it out. Hint is 33. 33 verses later, the Torah says, don't worship, don't offer to the demons. The exception is on Yom Kippur. And then it's not you, it's God. Why? To placate the Satan, who otherwise would prosecute the Jewish people. Does this make sense? Yes? Does it feel okay? Does it feel good or feels a little bit uncomfortable? I think it feels uncomfortable. I'm not comfortable with this. So I want to conclude with the following. A Hasidic interpretation of all of this. So what we have now, thus far, is an answer to all of our questions. Number one, what is the deeper meaning of this strange ritual to throw the goat off the cliff in a very barbaric way? Why we're feeding this demonic minister of doom, this Satan? And it's not in a pleasant way. It's a very barbaric way. It's a very whatever way. It's outside the temple because it's not... It's to that force. Why on Yom Kippur? To gain atonement. To gain the agreement, even from the dark side of evil, even from the side of negativity, the prosecuting side, even that side should acquiesce to the Jews. So it's not in the temple. It's not sacrificed. It's not chosen. It's done by girls. It's done by divine whatever. And that's what happens. Still a little bit uncomfortable, though, I think, at least for me. So the last thing I'll mention, a Hasidic interpretation, this comes from Rabbi of Lublin. What's his name? Rabbi, I think, Tzadok? Yeah, Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin. He was a Hasidic master, 1823 to 1900, and he shared the following. I'm going to paraphrase, and then we're going to close it out very quickly. So here is his point. What is Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur is a day of atonement. What does atonement mean? Let's talk about us. Forget about goats and forget about temple times. Let's talk about you and I. There's two dimensions of atonement. There's two dimensions of self-correction. The first and most basic level is, I've done something wrong. I will no longer do it in the future. I understand the error of my ways. I regret what I've done. I will no longer do it again. The past is history, and I've turned over a new leaf. That is the basic definition of tshuva, which means from now on, the slate is cleansed. But going back, if I were to go back in time, it's still sullied. It's still marred by the past decision that I made. It's still not so pure. There's a higher level of teshuva, which actually transforms the past. The higher level of tshuva, which, and we've talked about this in other contexts, the higher level of tshuva is where the past actually serves as an impetus, positive force for the present and future. It's because I disconnected, it's because I offended myself and others and God, and I made negative choices, it's because of that I'm so passionate today about making the right choice. So the negative is actually the greatest catalyst for positivity. Turns out that the past can be redefined as a positive. Not just from now on it's going to be positive, but even that episode was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because had that not happened, I would not have been in as good a place as I am today. It's because of that mistake that I've corrected it so intensely that I'm better off than had that never happened. That's how we reclaim the past. That's a higher level of tshuva. And that's called when you turn sin into a mitzvah. You can wipe out the sin and make it neutral, or on a deeper level, that's when you only pledge from now on not to do it again. But then you can transform the very sin into a mitzvah. It becomes now something positive. This perspective is born of one other piece, and that is, If I did this, if I had this life experience, even if it was my own choice, I know that there's a positive that can come out from it. I know that there's a lesson that I can learn that can impact me positively. Because if there wasn't, I wouldn't have done it. That doesn't mean that a person can go and do whatever they want and think to themselves, well, let me do all X, Y, and Z, because it's going to teach me a positive lesson for the future. We can't go into it that way. But the good news is we don't have to think of that to get into trouble, because we get into trouble anyway. So we get into trouble, but then looking backwards, we can say, this happened. This is part of my life story. And I know that as much as I'm in control and I have free choice, the fact that it happened means God signed off on it. And if God signed off on it, that means that there must be a positive that I can claim from that to propel me in the future. Does all this make sense? Yom Kippur is a day that we have a deeper level of teshuvah, which means that we start seeing how God, how beauty, how positivity is not only in the good moments that we've experienced, but even in the negative choices, even in those dark, desolate, destructive, self-destructive, and hurting other people moments in our lives, in the past year or in our lives in the past. Even in those moments, God was there, and there's still light and purpose there. So the Tzaddik of Lublin, Reb Tzaddik HaKohen, known as the Tzaddik, the holy Hasidic master of Lublin, he says that this is the deeper meaning of what the Ramban is saying, what Nachmanides is saying. On Yom Kippur, what is the service? We take the goat and we send it off the cliff and we send it toward the Satan. What's the message? Even in those moments that we've encountered negativity, we've encountered evil, even in moments where we've violated the very contract that our own integrity is based on, and the contract that binds our connection with God, even when we've violated that perhaps, God is still there. And there's still purpose there. And there's still light there. And there's still something positive that can be extracted from there. This is perhaps a Hasidic, not perhaps, this is a Hasidic, a deeper kind of inflection or way to understand Nachmani's interpretation. It's not so much black and white that we're feeding the negative force to placate it so that it doesn't prosecute the Jewish people on Yom Kippur, but rather what it means is that we recognize that on Yom Kippur, that even those moments in which we ventured off the cliff, in which we've harmed ourselves and others, even in those moments, there's something to be claimed, something to be reclaimed from those moments. There's some element of beauty to claim and to discover from that. And so with that in mind, I'd like to conclude with the following lesson. And that is, like I mentioned before, we don't need to intentionally come up with these types of calculations. Let me do this because that will lead me to a better path in the future, whatever it is. We, intentionally or unintentionally, we find ourselves kind of sometimes, off the cliff. We find ourselves like, whoa, how did I get here? I never intended to be here, but I found myself here now. The question is, what do we do after that? What do we do? Do we have the courage to see that even in here, even in this place, there lies light? Even in this place, I've been led to by God, even though it's my own choice. But do I have the courage and the faith to say that, yes, this too has been plotted. This path has been plotted by God. And therefore, there's some element of positivity that I can extract from here. Or do we take the more defeatist attitude and say, I messed up, this is terrible, look how low I've fallen, and then perhaps make another negative choice, considering ourselves at such a low position? The truth is that we are taught in Judaism to take the former approach and never the latter. And that is, no matter where we've been, no matter what we've seen, no matter what we've encountered, no matter how far we've fallen, and I don't want to make it too dramatic, but no matter what we've done, there's always some element of positivity. May we have the courage and the vision to see that, to discover the light, and indeed use whatever our experiences have been as a catalyst for future growth. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.